Part of today's show, or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's FAIR.org. The website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network or to subscribe to FAIR's newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock. First up tonight on KBOO's Evening Public Affairs is Rising Up with Sonali. The guest is Curry Peterson-Smith of the Institute for Policy Studies, discussing the recent Senate vote against U.S. involvement in the Yemen war, as well as the latest in the Afghanistan war and what's behind increased airstrikes on Somalia. Then, on The Struggle, host Alyssa Pariah interviews organizer Lamara Haynes about cis-focused feminism.
KBOO Community Radio, a proud co-sponsor of the Live Cinema Experience 100-Year Plan on Friday, March 15th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Disjecta in Portland. 100-Year Plan is a dystopian response to participating in the producer's economy in the age of automation takeover. This live cinema experience presents a performance of an online video in real life and is produced by Emotional Store. Again, that's 100-Year Plan on Friday, March 15th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Disjecta, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 18th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Dogma. This screening benefits Not Okay PDX. Again, that's Dogma, showing Monday, March 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, at least 49 people are dead in Christchurch, New Zealand, after a gunman opened fire on two mosques on Thursday. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern labeled it a terrorist attack and said it was one of New Zealand's darkest days.
It is clear that this can now only be described as a terrorist attack. From what we know, it does appear to have been well planned. Two explosive devices attached to suspects' vehicles have now been found and they have been disarmed. There are currently four individuals who have been apprehended, but three are connected to this attack who are currently in custody, one of which has publicly stated that they were Australian-born. These are people who I would describe as having extremist views that have absolutely no place in New Zealand and, in fact, have no place in the world.
That's New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern speaking on Thursday evening about the terrorist attack on two mosques in Christchurch. A portion of the New Zealand massacre was live streamed on Facebook as the shooter apparently wore a video recording device on his head. According to the New York Times, before the shooting, someone appearing to be the gunman posted links to a white nationalist manifesto on Twitter and 8chan, an online forum known for extremist right-wing discussions. The 8chan post included a link to what appeared to be the gunman's Facebook page, where he said he would also broadcast live video of the attack. President Donald Trump, who enjoys a lot of support on forums like 8chan, posted a tweet on Friday morning saying, "My warmest sympathy and best wishes go out to the people of New Zealand after the horrible massacres in the mosques." A total of four people, three men and one woman, have been taken into custody. At least one of them is Australian. One man in his 20s has been charged with murder and will appear in court on Saturday. Elsewhere in the world, the U.S. has also apparently influenced violence and gun culture. In Brazil, where a school shooting shocked the nation earlier this week, it has now been revealed that the two young men responsible for the massacre were inspired by the 1999 Columbine shooting in Colorado. According to AP, friends and former classmates told investigators that 17-year-old Guillermo Tauchi Monteiro and 25-year-old Enrique de Castro were obsessed with the attack on Columbine High School. They had apparently been planning the attack at the high school for months. Here in the U.S., parents of those killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre celebrated a victory after the Connecticut Supreme Court opened an avenue for them to sue gun manufacturers. The victims' parents had filed a suit challenging the immunity that Congress has given gun makers against being liable for how their weapons are used. The manufacturer of the Bushmaster rifle used by the Sandy Hook shooter had been advertised with the slogan, "Consider your man card reissued." A 4-3 ruling by the state Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling that, quote, "it falls to a jury to decide whether the promotional schemes alleged in the present case rise to the level of illegal trade practices and whether fault for the tragedy can be laid at their feet." Nicole Hockley, the mother of a 6-year-old boy who was among those killed, said, "No one has blanket immunity. There are consequences. We want our day in court to see why they do this way and what needs to change." In other news, the U.S. Senate issued its second rebuke to President Trump in 2 days with the passage of a resolution disapproving of his national emergency declaration to obtain border wall funding. 12 Republican senators, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Rand Paul, Mitt Romney, Mike Lee, Lamar Alexander, Jerry Moran, Pat Toomey, Rob Portman, Roger Wicker, Roy Blunt, and Marco Rubio, joined Democrats in voting for the measure, which has already passed the House. This final Senate vote was 59-41. It's the first time in American history that both chambers of Congress have voted against a president's declaration of national emergency. Trump has already said he will veto it. In the days leading up to the vote, Trump apparently called several GOP senators and urged them to vote against the resolution, saying it would be equivalent to a vote against him, and threatening their political futures if they didn't comply. The ploy obviously didn't work. Speaking to reporters on Thursday alongside Ireland's Prime Minister, Trump addressed Britain's struggle with negotiating a Brexit deal. As usual, he made the story all about him and criticized Prime Minister Theresa May's approach.
I was standing out on Turnberry, and we had a press conference, and people were screaming. That was the day before, if you remember. I think you were there. And people were screaming, and I said, "No, I think it's going to happen." And people were surprised I made the prediction, and because President Obama made the opposite prediction, and I was right. And I will tell you, I'm surprised at how badly it's all gone from the standpoint of a negotiation. But I gave the Prime Minister my ideas on how to negotiate it, and I think you would have been successful. She didn't listen to that, and that's fine. I mean, she's got to do what she's got to do, but I think it could have been negotiated in a different manner, frankly.
That's President Trump on Thursday speaking to reporters at the White House about the Brexit negotiations. Of course, Trump made no mention of North Korea, where his self-declared negotiating skills have had an embarrassing failure. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is apparently on the verge of deciding whether or not to continue talks with the U.S. and others and keep his moratorium on missile testing in place. Vice Foreign Minister Choi Sun-hui addressed the reporters on Thursday and expressed her nation's disappointment in how the recent summit in Hanoi between President Trump and Mr. Kim transpired. According to AP, Choi, who attended the February 27th, 28th talks in Hanoi, said Kim was puzzled by what she called the eccentric negotiation position of the U.S. She suggested that while Trump was more willing to talk, an atmosphere of hostility and mistrust was created by the uncompromising demands of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton. She said statements by senior Trump advisors since the summit have further worsened the climate. More details have emerged from the fatal air crash of the Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 8. Apparently, the plane's captain immediately realized there were problems minutes after takeoff when the plane reached an abnormally high speed. The pilot is now known to have desperately sought permission to land as air traffic controllers scrambled to divert other flights. Air traffic controllers say they watched the plane dip up and down by hundreds of feet, indicating clearly that there were serious problems. After 5 minutes in the air, they lost all communication with the pilots. Similar problems were observed with the Lion Air crash over Indonesia less than 6 months ago. The majority of nations that have Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft have grounded the planes. And that does it for our headlines today. After the break, we'll turn to Corey Peterson-Smith of the Institute for Policy Studies to discuss the recent Senate vote against U.S. involvement in the Yemen war, as well as the latest in the Afghanistan war, and what's behind increased airstrikes on Somalia. Next, we'll hear about an innovative approach to ending the stranglehold of the Electoral College in U.S. presidential elections. Patrick Rosenstiel with National Popular Vote, Inc. will explain how a growing number of states are passing bills to transfer all their votes to the winner of the popular vote. Stay tuned to learn just how it works. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The U.S. Senate on Wednesday passed a resolution to end involvement in Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. The measure passed 54-47 and heads to the House, where it will likely pass. The bill marks a rare show of partisan unity against President Donald Trump. It passed the Senate last December, but not the Republican-controlled House, so it was revived again in the Senate this year. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who pushed for the bill, said in a statement, U.S. participation in this war has not been authorized by Congress and is therefore unconstitutional. For the first time in 45 years, Congress must exercise its power under the War Powers Resolution and remove the U.S. from this war in Yemen. Trump has already said he will veto the bill if it passes both chambers. Still, it's considered a big victory by anti-war activists. My guest is Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali. Happy to be here.
So we've had this move happen, this legislation being introduced, voted on several times since especially the brutal killing last year of the Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Turkish embassy, in a move that is very directly linked to the very top Saudi leadership that seemed to spur the U.S. Congress about supporting the Saudi Arabians' war in Yemen. the Senate has supported this. 54 senators have signed on to it. Does this indicate strong Republican discontent at the war?
Well, it's a very good question. I will say that, of course, the Republicans have been supporting Trump throughout all of his the horrendous things that he's done in this country and abroad. And the few times that the Republicans have seemed to be willing to dissent with the president is actually when there are questions of the U.S.'s activities abroad, actually, with what the U.S. is doing elsewhere. And so when Trump decided, for example, to unilaterally pull out of the U.S. operations or end U.S. operations in Syria, this provoked frustration and outrage among among senators or among Republicans. When some of Trump's activities regarding North Korea have inspired friction with his own party. And so what we're seeing is a Republican Party that by and large has accepted what Trump's program is, but when it comes to what they see as threats to U.S. power abroad, then in some cases they're willing to break ranks. It is worth noting that it was seven Republican senators who broke ranks and voted with the Democrats on this resolution. Now, that is not some huge number, but it's significant given, again, the kind of unity that they have shown with Trump in it. And again, given the momentum against the U.S.'s ongoing support for the war in Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen.
So the Senate did pass it once before last year when, and then it wasn't taken up in the House because the Republicans in the House, there just wasn't support for it. They wouldn't have passed it. So it came up again this year and passed the Senate a second time, is likely to pass the Democratic-controlled House. Trump has said he will veto it. Let's talk about the War Powers resolution on which this bill is based. We often talk about Congress being the one that has the authority to declare war. But since 9/11, it seems as though Congress has essentially turned over all its power to the executive branch, right?
Well, that's true. And I do want to just say a word. If we're talking about the context for this decision and for what seems to be a growing assertiveness among people in Congress regarding the right to make war by the United States, I want to talk about what that war has actually looked like. And of course, the situation in Yemen has been called the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. Some 20 million people in Yemen are hungry. It's two-thirds of the population. So this has really been absolutely catastrophic. And of course, we've seen the events, not only Saudi Arabia's essentially murder, assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, which garnered so much attention, but also last year's bombing of a school bus full of children in Yemen as well. And so Saudi Arabia has done a number of things, high-profile crimes that have been visible for everybody to see. And whereas they've counted on unwavering U.S. support historically, that is now starting to waver. And so, yes, there is this question now of Congress asserting itself, not only regarding the question of making war, but also at the same time as this vote, which will go to the House and then will go to Trump to veto. At the same time as that's happening, Congress is also deliberating around the question of Trump declaring state of emergency at the border, which there are people in Congress who also oppose. And so there is a contest around who gets to exercise U.S. power and how and for what.
What is the link you feel between the emergency declaration of the border issue and this? I mean, is it just that he faces a rebuke from at least sections of his party on both of these issues?
Right. Well, that is certainly a link. And in terms of who has actually supported the legislation itself in both cases, of course, different people in Congress will support it for different reasons. You have people who are very right-wing who supported Wednesday's resolution regarding Yemen, and you have people like Bernie Sanders, of course, co-authored the resolution. And so they may be compelled for different reasons, but it is the case, I think, that this has been true, actually, since Trump took office. There's been a question among the establishment here in Washington, D.C., about how responsible and capable Trump is of exercising U.S. power abroad. And so I think that that's part of what this is about. If Trump acts recklessly and acts in ways that endanger U.S.'s ability to exercise power abroad, there are people in his own power, or in his own party, rather, who will push back. And in fact, Mike Lee, the representative from Utah, essentially said as much, said that this is a question of the U.S.'s ability to exercise diplomacy around the world. The U.S. cannot both support Saudi Arabia as it assassinates journalists and then come across as a diplomat. So there's a number of reasons why there are people in both parties who are challenging the president's powers.
Does this vote, which we know will be vetoed by the president when it passes the House, but does it also send a message to the Saudis that they may have a friend in the White House for now, but a future president, especially if this congressional makeup remains, may take a very different line? And of course, all of this is happening while the Saudi leadership is still reeling from the accusations around the Jamal Khashoggi murder, but they're also now facing scrutiny over their imprisonment and torture of women's rights activists, the women who'd been agitating to allow women to begin driving legally in Saudi Arabia, although it is now legal for women to do so. Those initial activists who began agitating remain imprisoned. There's U.S. scrutiny on that. Does this vote send a warning signal to the Saudis?
Well, it's a good question, and ultimately I think that it remains to be seen. I will say that there is a new questioning of the U.S.'s alliances in the Middle East and what the U.S. does in the Middle East here in Washington. And the most obvious example, of course, is not only has Saudi Arabia, the U.S.'s relationship with Saudi Arabia, been in the spotlight, particularly over the past year, but increasingly its relationship with Israel as well. As we know, Representative Ilhan Omar calling attention to the relationship, to the question of the Israel lobby, and so on. So I do think that fundamentally, this is a signal to the White House itself, but there's a number of things are being thrown up regarding the U.S.'s long-term allies in the Middle East and U.S. operations and activities in the Middle East and so on. And really, there's the relationships themselves and what the U.S. does, but also who gets to decide. You know, is it the president? Is it the Congress? Et cetera.
Let's turn to some of the other places where the U.S. is fighting wars, from which there has been news recently but hasn't been receiving as much attention. The U.S. remains in Afghanistan in particular. In fact, there was a recent U.S. bombing that ended up accidentally, I suppose, killing 5 Afghan soldiers. It was supposed to be a sort of friendly fire incident, but it was a reminder that the U.S. is continuing to actively fight a war, but it's also holding peace talks with members of the Taliban, which it has done many times in the past. But these peace talks seem different. They've gone on for longer, and now there's some movement that there are even some draft agreements in place. Corey, what do you know? What's the latest on the prospects for the U.S. war in Afghanistan to actually be wrapping up?
Right. Well, this is in part a question of the U.S.'s whole posture abroad. The U.S. has these ongoing wars at the same time as it's trying to orient to the future of U.S. empire, which helps explain Trump's activities in Asia, particularly his negotiations with North Korea. There is, of course, the U.S.'s ongoing presence here in this hemisphere and what it has done in Latin America, which was quiet in recent years. And now, of course, as the U.S. is working to quite openly foment a coup in Venezuela, set of activities and set of relationships has come back on the table. So truthfully, I think that there is a kind of figuring out of what the U.S.'s posture abroad is. And on one hand, the pursuit of talks with the Taliban is an indication of that, and trying to figure out exactly how to negotiate the U.S.'s presence or absence in Afghanistan. On the other hand, as you say, what this indicates is that the so-called war on terror continues. And if we can circle back to Yemen, I think that that's actually an important thing to call attention to in the midst of. We are rightly positive about the fact that there is a questioning of U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen. The fact is, however, additionally, the United States has its own war in Yemen under the heading of the War on Terror that predates this conflict that Saudi Arabia has been waging. And that actually continues. And so, in fact, on January 1st, on New Year's Day, Central Command, the United States Central Command, tweeted about how it carried out a drone assassination in Yemen. And so that war is ongoing, and it is good if people in Congress are calling attention to the U.S.'s support for Saudi Arabia and the UAE's war. But I am also for us having more scrutiny about what the U.S. is doing itself directly in its own military operations in Yemen and in Afghanistan. Those are the semi-open ones. Then there are all the clandestine wars across Africa and around the world and so on.
Let's turn to those. We saw Somalia drift into the news briefly earlier this year, or just a few weeks ago, with the release of data showing that the U.S. has been increasing its airstrikes in Somalia. In the last 4 months of last year, hundreds of people were killed in airstrikes, and this year is on pace to break records. And essentially, it sounds like the United States is now on a near daily basis dropping airstrikes in Somalia and killing hundreds. Presumably their target is the Al-Shabaab militant organization. What is the U.S.'s war in Somalia, and why is Congress seemingly ignoring it?
Well, you know, it's an important question, and I think this is why, even as there is a growing questioning of particular U.S. activities and particular U.S. support for regimes like that in Saudi Arabia, it is worth stepping back and seeing the fact that overall the posture is one that is an even more aggressive posture regarding the use of military force around the world. The so-called war on terror, what's evident over the past 17 years, going on 18 years, is that there really is no end game. If the idea is to supposedly hunt down terrorists or various other actors, we know, as Jeremy Scahill points out in his book and in his film Dirty Wars, when the U.S. assembles a so-called kill list of enemies, the kill list simply multiplies and there are more enemies. And that's not surprising, not only because of the U.S.'s vague definitions of who falls into the enemy category, but also the fact that the U.S.'s activities themselves produced more responses to the United States. And so what we have is really an open-ended and increasingly aggressive and increasingly unaccountable ongoing set of military operations. In fact, as people may know, Trump recently announced that there will be no publishing of data regarding the killing of civilians in the U.S.'s ongoing drone campaigns all around the world.
Right. Wasn't this something that the Obama administration had been essentially forced into doing after years of work by grassroots anti-war activists?
That's exactly right. And so the Obama administration is credited with this provision that says that the United States has to publish data regarding the civilians killed in drone strikes. It's important to note that it was the Obama administration that wildly escalated the drone war. But yes, because of the pressure of different groups calling attention to it, we won that provision to at least know on some level, or at least the United States is supposed to be compelled to publish the data of what civilians are killed. Now the Trump administration is saying even that is too much in terms of accountability. So the U.S.'s overall posture is increasingly more aggressive and less accountable.
I mean, us just staying on Somalia for a little bit longer, essentially in the first part of 2019, there have been 25 airstrikes that killed 244 fighters of Al-Shabaab, which is supposed to be affiliated to Al-Qaeda. So the U.S. is just dropping these bombs on targets that it thinks are affiliated with Al-Shabaab, that it's finding training camps and dropping them. But no one is actually paying attention, at least here in the United States, to whether all of those people killed are Al-Shabaab. And even if they were members of Al-Shabaab, why they deserve to be executed, right? It's extrajudicial assassination, essentially, and really keeping track of it. I mean, all of this is now that we also heard that the U.S. conducted an airstrike after U.S. troops came under attack. Well, if the U.S. troops weren't there in the first place, they wouldn't have come under attack. Speaking to the point you made earlier about the U.S.'s sheer presence creating these scenarios where more violence is seemingly required, shouldn't the Senate take up and shouldn't even progressives in the Senate and the House start drawing attention to the Somalia war? Why are we there? What are we fighting? Why are we dropping increasing numbers of bombs?
Well, that's absolutely right. And one thing that's evident, again, over the past 17 going on 18 years, is that the United States government itself has been very reluctant to hold itself and its military accountable for any of its activities. And on the contrary, what we've seen is a growing number of provisions over the years to make U.S. military power less accountable. And so it's really, I think, on those of us in social movements to call attention to the U.S.'s ongoing wars and expose them and demand knowledge of them. One of the things that is difficult about resisting a clandestine war is that we don't know what's happening. And so even demanding the right to know what the U.S. is doing is absolutely critical. But yes, of course, the U.S. should end all of its wars that are taking place, all of which are killing civilians, and all of which involves the completely unaccountable exercise of military power. It also must be said, since we're talking about Somalia, not only has the United States contributed to making Somalia, to bringing catastrophe into the everyday lives of Somali people, the United States then restricts those people from leaving their country, because Somalis are among the people who are banned actually from emigrating to the United States or even traveling to the United States. And so there are crimes against Somalis at every turn in terms of what the United States does in their home country and in terms of what the United States does to keep them from leaving and to keep them from entering this country. And so progressives must demand an end to all of these measures. We must make it such that Somalis and anybody else can enter this country as refugees, but also the U.S. must stop the activities that are producing these refugee situations to begin with.
Right. We have Afghans, Iraqis, Somalis, all of the countries that we're dropping bombs in and have, and Yemenis, of course, who are hard-pressed to actually leave. But these countries that where we are creating not just internally displaced people, but of course people who are attempting to flee those countries, and then we are criminalizing them, our allies in Europe are criminalizing them, we're making it difficult for them to resettle. So that's certainly another part of it that isn't being discussed. We're also, it seems, as so, Corey, we're seeing this a president who made it a point to question endless wars, which of course is a good thing, but then befriended weapons manufacturers. I mean, we have essentially a Boeing guy in the Defense Department acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan he was a Boeing executive, worked for Boeing for over 31 years. He's, not only is he likely to prevent the U.S. or stand in the way of the U.S. properly regulating passenger aircraft in the wake of the Ethiopian Airlines crash. But of course, this is a manufacturer of fighter jets, right?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, the weapons manufacturers essentially have total impunity to do whatever they want. And on one hand, it is outrageous for Trump to embrace corporations of all stripes the way that he does, in particular to embrace weapons manufacturers quite explicitly. But as with so many things that Trump does, he is making explicit what has been practice for generations regarding weapons manufacturers. And when we talk about war making, really for the duration of the history of the United States, I mean, the United States, the whole project of the United States involves endless war, truthfully. So, yes, the impunity with which weapons manufacturers kind of work with the government and exercise their own power, that is something that is outrageous and it has to be opposed. My hope is that by Trump revealing those relationships and revealing that level of commitment to U.S. violence, that more and more people come into recognizing not only what the things that that have become more visible, like the U.S.'s ongoing, you know, catastrophic activities and support for activities in Yemen, not only what the U.S. does in Afghanistan, et cetera, but all of what the U.S. is doing, and that the whole notion of this, the so-called war on terror, has to be questioned and challenged and critiqued and ended, I think, is really our challenge. Moreover, you know, even when we're talking about the U.S.'s negotiations in Asia, on the Korean Peninsula, for example, which on one hand, it involves some very important breakthroughs. We're talking about things, and this is not only the United States program, it's a question of South Korea, diplomacy between South Korea and North Korea as well. And so there is a conversation now about reducing the U.S. troop presence in South Korea, you know, suspending U.S. military exercises in South Korea, which are a regular feature of the U.S.'s presence in the Korean Peninsula and the U.S.'s relationship with South Korea. It's good that we're talking about those things, but really the long-term vision is one that's about how can the U.S. set itself up in Asia to deal with China, and that is something that we can't accept. And so, really, I think calling attention to the overall kind of projects and visions of what the U.S. is committed to is very important, especially because that commitment runs very deep. It runs very deep. It is absolutely critical when there is opposition to particular activities that the U.S. Does, the opposition in Congress, that's crucial. But the kind of fundamental commitment to U.S. power abroad is something that is so foundational to the U.S. government, and it's something that we really have to challenge.
Right. Well, I'm really glad you brought up the issue of North and South Korea as well. That has also faded into the background these days. Corey, where's the best place for people to read the work that you do and read your writings?
Sure. If you go to ips-dc.org, you can read the work of all the people here at the Institute for Policy Studies, including my own work.
Wonderful. We'll link to that. Thank you so much, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali.
Corey Peterson-Smith is Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing the Senate vote on Yemen, as well as the wars in Afghanistan and Somalia. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A national movement to abolish the Electoral College through something called the National Popular Vote System is gaining steam. In just the last few weeks, according to a report in Salon, Delaware's Senate passed legislation to join the compact and send that bill to its house, where it has passed twice before. In Colorado, where one legislative chamber was first to pass NPV legislation in 2006, a compact bill recently passed both chambers and is heading to a governor ready to sign it. New Mexico's Senate just passed the bill and sent it to its house. A bill currently has bipartisan support in Michigan and Oregon. Meanwhile, the Washington Post published an op-ed about the idea on Tuesday, written by Massachusetts House Democrat Seth Moulton. Moulton wrote, "If we abolish the Electoral College, presidential candidates could earn votes anywhere, making them far more likely to campaign everywhere. Then, no matter where you live or how your neighbors vote, your vote would matter, as it should." Well, some months ago, we had covered the national popular vote idea, and today we'll rebroadcast that interview.
Chief among the many rallying cries in the wake of the disastrous 2016 presidential election were calls to abolish the electoral college system in the U.S. Donald Trump lost the popular vote by nearly 3 million, but scraped by with just enough gains in the right states to win the Electoral College vote and become president with a minority mandate. Only the fourth time such a thing has happened in U.S. history. The original intent of the founders was to undermine the direct election of a president by popular vote because they were afraid that a demagogue would rise to power through manipulating the public. Little did they know that in 2016, a demagogue was able to use the Electoral College to achieve the same ends. Now, a new and little-known nationwide effort has taken root to end the power of the Electoral College in our presidential elections. It's called the National Popular Vote, and here is former Labor Secretary and author Robert Reich explaining exactly how it works.
While we resist Donald Trump, we also need to make sure our democracy doesn't ever again elect a candidate who loses the popular vote. We must abolish the Electoral College. Now, as you probably know, the Constitution assigns each state a number of electors based on the state's population. The total number of electors is 538. So anyone who gets 270 of those Electoral College votes becomes president, regardless of the popular vote. So how do we abolish the Electoral College? Amending the Constitution is very hard, requiring a two-thirds vote by the House and Senate, plus approval by three-quarters of state legislatures. But we can make the Electoral College irrelevant without a constitutional amendment. Here's how. Article 2 of the Constitution says states can award their electors any way they want. So all that's needed is for states with a total of at least 270 electors to agree to award all their electoral votes to the presidential candidate who wins the popular vote. If they do that, then automatically the winner of the popular vote gets the 270 electoral votes he or she needs to become president. Already, 10 states and the District of Columbia have passed laws to do exactly this, awarding all their electoral votes to the candidate who wins the popular vote as soon as the 270 elector goal is met. Together, these states total 165 electoral votes. So all we need now is some additional states with 105 electors to pass the same law, agreeing to reward all their electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote. And it's done. We'll never again elect a president who loses the popular vote. The effort is known as the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. If your state hasn't yet joined on, make sure it does.
And that is former Labor Secretary and prominent progressive activist Robert Reich explaining this effort to end the power of the Electoral College. We turn now to Patrick Rosensteel. He's senior consultant to National Popular Vote, Inc. Welcome to the program, Patrick.
Oh, thanks. Grateful to be here.
So we just heard Robert Reich explaining what this National Popular Vote Pact is. It's pretty incredible and innovative. It was the first time that I'd heard about it when someone posted this to Facebook, but this is a movement that's been afoot. Can you explain how it all started and how far it's actually gotten?
Oh, yeah, sure. Happy to. You know, I think Dr. Koza, who's our chairman, first drafted up some of the language around the Interstate Compact in 2005. We were in front of the first legislative bodies in 2006. So we have states with 172 electoral votes that have passed our bill. You know, to understand the compact is to understand we need states with 98 more to reach the 270 electoral vote threshold. At which point it triggers, and we get to elect a president of the United States by a national popular vote, and we get to fix a system that's been broken for quite some time, you know, to make every voter in every state politically relevant in every presidential election. So the reason it started is because too many American voters are left on the sideline, Republican, Democrat, or independent in presidential years. We believe a national popular vote for president can fix that problem so that a voter in North Dakota is as important to the American president as a voter in the battleground state of Florida. And we believe that the compact is the constitutionally appropriate way because the legislature has the authority and the power under the U.S. Constitution to address this problem if they believe it exists.
Right. So right now, for example, in California, where I'm based, our program is based, come general election time during a presidential election year, we get very little campaigning by candidates because it's a state that's been written off as reliably Democratic. The same goes for states that are written off as reliably Republican. And it's in those few swing states where the vote could go here or there that get the greatest attention from candidates and also sort of have their issues be made more important. So I know Californians always complain about really not being considered very much during the general election. If this were to go through, if enough states whose electoral college votes added up to 270 agreed to put all of their votes towards the winner of the popular election, then you would have to have candidates, or candidates would have to feel that they needed to win over every single individual vote, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, what we do is replace a system of battleground states and flyover states with a system where every American voter becomes a battleground state voter. And, you know, the problem is the influence of the battleground state, right? So right now, if you read any political news, you read about, you know, sort of the threat of the trade war and what that might mean for rural economies in the Midwest or the American South or export-based economies like Oregon and California. And the reason we're in the middle of a trade war is because the current president, President Trump, needed to figure out a way to win Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Rust Belt areas of Rust Belt states, in order to win those states to be elected president under the current state-based winner-take-all system. Now, under a national popular vote system, it's not that trade-related issues are not going to be important. They're just not going to be decided in a parochial vacuum where the interests of battleground state voters are placed ahead of the interests of every other voter in the country. So, you know, battleground states are twice as likely, for example, to get exemptions from programs like No Child Left Behind, and they're more likely to get presidentially controlled grants, more likely to get disasters declared. And I know that's a big deal in a lot of places, but certainly near and dear to the hearts of the voters of California. A battleground state is twice as likely to get a natural disaster declared as a flyover state is. And that's simply because of the state-based winner-take-all law that the national popular vote proposal replaces. And we just believe that battleground state issues will be on equal footing, not as flyover state issues in a presidential campaign, if we move to a national popular vote system for electing
So some of the numbers you just gave show that it's not just about how things are distributed during a general election, but year-round between elections, swing states and battleground states, as they're called, seem to be favored because of this power that they have through the Electoral College system. So what are some of the states that have already joined in? So we said 11 states adding up to 165 electoral votes, and among them New York and California have already joined. So those are two big states with big numbers of electoral college votes. What are some of the other states that have joined?
We've got small states, we've got medium-sized states, and we've got big states, and you rattled off a few. Mm-hmm. What's important to understand is this is not a partisan approach to a nonpartisan problem, right? It's a nonpartisan approach to a nonpartisan problem, or a bipartisan approach to a nonpartisan problem. So we've passed, for example, the House of Representatives in the Republican state of Arizona, and we passed the Oklahoma Senate because, you know, look, Republicans and Democrats alike are tired of being trapped behind, you know, either the blue wall or the red wall, you know, depending on what flyover state they live in. So,
and in fact, I understand that one of the founder of National Popular Vote identifies as a Republican.
Oh, one of them does, and one of them doesn't. I mean, okay. This is a reform that enjoys. So, you know, Donald Trump supports a national popular vote for president.
He does.
Newt Gingrich supports, you know, sort of a national popular vote and the national popular vote in interstate compact, as does Nancy Pelosi, right? So, you know, we got Michael Steele on board and Howard Dean. You know, anytime you can get sort of, you know, bipartisan support to a significant nonpartisan issue. You know, it's something that that everybody should take relatively seriously. Do their homework, maybe at nationalpopularvote.com. Figure out whether you're for or against this idea and weigh in with your state legislature.
So in addition to Connecticut, we have Rhode Island, Vermont, Hawaii, the District of Columbia, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Illinois, New York, California. That leaves still plenty of states, behind that that are able to join this. Are there places where states are now, state legislative bodies are now considering passing a bill to join in?
Oh yeah, we have bills introduced in every legislative session in every state that has not adopted the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. We've passed one chamber or another in a number of states where we continue to work on those states. Arizona and Oklahoma are two great examples of that. Certainly we've been active in a lot of places. We have bills dropped in all 50, well, not all 50 states anymore because we've passed 12, but the truth is Nash, we've got our shoulder to the wheel at National Popular Vote until this work is done in a bipartisan fashion to fix the problems with the current system and move to a national popular vote for president. I don't make any predictions about what state might fall next, but we certainly are active on a daily basis trying to get this job done. And the reason we're so successful is because the American people of all stripes, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Conservatives, liberals, and moderates are tired of a system where battleground state voters have all the power, flyover state voters have none. And the reason we're successful is because folks are willing to weigh in with their legislature, which is where you need to call if you want to get your shoulder to the wheel.
Right. So for people who might live in one of the states that I didn't mention, where this hasn't, meant to mention Washington as well, is one of the states that has passed it. So aside from the states that I mentioned, there are efforts, and people can simply contact their state legislatures, find out if there's a bill, and urge them to support it and push those lawmakers to start holding hearings on it and actually holding votes.
Yeah, and also if you go to nationalpopularvote.com and if you click on your state, it will have sort of the legislative vehicle that was most recently under consideration in that state. It'll have the name of the chief author. If you go to our Write Legislator page, which is a great way to do this, you can type in your zip code. If you need to figure out who your state legislator is, write them a note. But there is state by state history of the National Popular Vote Bill in all 50 states in the District of Columbia. So if you're interested in knowing where your state is, that's a great place to go, and you can gather the information there.
Right. So right on the top of the website is a list of links to states, and you can just click on your link to find out what the status of your particular state is, and if who you need to contact in order to push for it if you think this is a good idea. When did this effort start, Patrick? I'm wondering about the pace of these bills passing.
I think we wrote the bill in 2005. I think it went before its first legislatures in 2006. And I think the first state passed the bill in 2007. And so, you know, the pace of change is actually pretty swift if you consider the fact that, the Civil Rights Act took, 30 years to pass. I mean, we like the progress we're making. We feel very good about the fact that we've come a long ways in a short period of time. And we're confident that the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is going to be law in enough states to have a national popular vote election. I don't make predictions about 2016, 2020, 2024. I just know that we're going to be there until it's done. And we feel great about the progress we're making.
And given that in 2016, so 10 years after you started this effort, we had the fourth time in U.S. history where a president won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote. I wonder if that's given greater impetus to these efforts states.
Well, I mean, look, divergence elections have happened, right? That's what they call them in political science. And, we don't make any guesses about what would have happened in a 2016 election if there was a national popular vote election, right?
two-thirds of the campaign happens in just six states under the current system. In a national popular vote, I'm sure that Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump, or President Trump, would have run their campaigns completely differently. And there would be an outcome, you know, and whoever won the most votes would win. You know, certainly it raised awareness about what we were doing, you know, and you know, we have capitalized on that awareness in terms of educating the public. But, you know, we've been at this for a little while. This isn't about one election or another. This is about every presidential election. Too many voters in America don't feel like they have a legitimate stake in the outcome of the election. And we need to fix that problem for every presidential.
You mentioned two-thirds of the campaigning takes place in six states. That's insane.
Yeah, in 2016, and 94% of the campaign happened in just 12. So, you know,
wow.
The idea that the national popular vote election in 2016 and Hillary Clinton would have been elected president ignores the fact that if you change the system, you change the nature of the campaign, and you couldn't possibly know what that outcome was going to be. We're just not afraid, meaning the proponents of reform here, we're not afraid to have a system where the candidates take their message to all the American people, and the candidate with the best message for all the American people is elected president. And we think that candidates ought be forced to campaign the interests of ruby red Oklahoma and bright blue Connecticut and every state in between. Mm. And whoever's got the best message of resonance ought to be elected president of the United States, and right now we're simply electing a president of the battleground states.
So, Patrick, what do you...
I have to say real quick that that was true for Barack Obama. That was every bit as true for Barack Obama as it is for Donald Trump, and it was every bit as true for George W. Bush as it was for Bill Clinton, right? They all campaigned to the battleground states, and we think that's a tragedy.
I mean, and that's by design. You can't blame them for doing so, given the current system. How do you respond to the argument that the Electoral College system is designed to protect those teeny tiny small states against the big states like California and Texas and New York?
Well, I respond to it by saying it's simply not true. I mean, the current system marginalizes small states unlike any other system could. So, for example, the 10 smallest states in the country, right, for the last 20 years, no Republican or Democratic candidate for president during the general election campaign has gone to any of the 10 smallest states in this country. And it's because five of them are reliably blue and Democratic, and five of them are reliably red. So it's the current system that marginalizes small states. Now, national popular vote will make a voter in North Dakota or Vermont every bit of as relevant as a voter in Volusia County, Florida, and the current system cannot fulfill that promise. So if you want to make small state voters matter, if you want to make rural voters matter in every presidential election, if you want to make suburban and urban voters matter, no matter what state they live in, right, national popular vote is the only way to do that. And the right way to move to a national popular vote is through the state-based compact that you can read at nationalpopularvote.com.
Now, some might say that this is anti, you know, having a national popular vote like this would disadvantage Republicans because we've seen, you know, more sort of minority rule in some state levels, and also given Trump won the Electoral College vote but lost the popular vote. For those Republicans who might be listening?
Well, look, you have a Republican on your Skype cast right now. Mm. I mean, I've cared more water for the elephant than most. You know, the truth is I'm a Republican who's not afraid of my ideas. I'd certainly like to take our ideas to the entire American people in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. You know, I think we've got a vibrant message of hope and growth and opportunity, and I think the Democrats have a vibrant message of their own. You know, I have no fear about sort of Republicans being able to compete in a first-past-the-post system where the candidate with the most votes wins in a single-member district called the United States of America. And the truth is we need to find, I mean, I'm tired of my party, the Republican Party, getting transactional with battleground state voters under the current system. Like I said just before, I sort of agree with President Trump. I think if we had a national popular vote for president, he would have run his campaign completely differently. And I'm not convinced that Hillary Clinton would have won that campaign. But look, I'm not here to talk about politics. I'm here to talk about a systemic problem with a systemic solution that is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. I come from a philosophy of, you know, let's get the best candidates with the best ideas out there talking to the American people and the citizens they want to represent. And I'm not afraid to create an environment where we line up and beat each other. And when the American people select the Republican or the Democratic candidate for president, I'd just like to know that as a Republican in a blue state like Minnesota, I've been able to cast my ballot. I feel like I've been a relevant participant in that effort. And my candidate won or lost, I can accept that, right? The current system might get ignored.
Hmm. Well, Patrick, give out that website again, just in case people don't remember.
Yeah, no, it's nationalpopularvote.com. And, you know, get engaged. Tell them if you want one, tell them you want one. If you don't want one, tell them you don't want one. But this is not going away.
Right.
We think every voter in every state should be relevant in the next presidential election, and we're hopeful that can occur.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
Patrick Rosensteel is senior consultant to National Popular Vote, Inc. We've been discussing this innovative effort to end the stranglehold of the Electoral College. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.